Turning now to the first book of Samuel, chapter 1 and verse 2. 1 Samuel, chapter 1, verse 2. And speaking of Elkanah, and he had two wives. The name of the one was Hannah, and the name of the other, Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. We've been studying the book of Judges, the demonstrations of faith in the time of the judges, in the book of Judges, and it leads us inevitably to the last of the judges, who was Samuel. And in the chapters before us, if we have time, we'll cover the birth and the call of Samuel, the last of the judges, and the first of a new order of prophets, the revival of prophecy. Of course, there was patriarchal prophecy. Abraham was a prophet. Other patriarchs uttered prophecies, notably, of course, Jacob. Amazing, wonderful, far-reaching promises to Christ and beyond. But then there was Moses, the greatest prophet of all. But between him and Samuel, there were none. Or just no great public prophets. There are here and there just a reference to an individual prophet. There's one in the book of Judges in chapter 6 who appears from nowhere and pronounces against the people. There's one here in 1 Samuel chapter 2, an individual prophet. So there were some, but there was no public prophecy generally, no regular prophets until the order of prophecy is resumed with Samuel. So he's very special, because he's a judge, the last of the judges, and he's a prophet. And all these offices that God gave ultimately will picture Christ. Well, you know the priesthood. And of course, the great high priest was a picture of Christ. In fact, the whole priesthood of the Old Testament and their function, to represent God to man and man to God. And that was really a picture of the great work of Christ. Then there were kings, of course, judges, deliverers in the time of the judges. And Christ was a deliverer, and he is our king, our eternal king. And then there they are, prophets, priests, kings, and judges, in a sense, because they were deliverers, also did the work that Christ united with his high priesthood and delivered the people. So here is a period of transition from judges to prophets. And 1 Samuel is very important to track this and to follow this. And I'm sure you're very familiar with the narrative of these early chapters, at least in 1 Samuel. And so I'm going to be able to proceed quite rapidly and bring out some of the great themes. In another study, we'll look at the purpose of the whole book. In fact, both of these books of Samuel, first and second, the overriding themes. But we'll come straight into the narrative. And in verse 2, there are the two wives, Hannah, which means grace or favoured, and Peninnah, which used to be thought to mean pearl, but nowadays the experts rather prefer her to be thought of as ruby. Well, she was neither, of course. Her main characteristic, Peninnah, as we see in a few verses, is that she had an exceptionally loud voice, and she used it. But she didn't really have the charm and grace and quiet spirit of a gemstone, so least of all a pearl, but her name is either pearl or ruby. But there were the two women. Now, Hannah possibly was Hyrcanus's first wife. Possibly. And she was childless, so he married another woman who bore children. And the one scorned the other. And we pick up the narrative in verse 3. Elkanah went up out of his city yearly to worship and to sacrifice unto the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. Elkanah was a Levite, and Samuel, of course, in due course would be a Levite boy. Possibly Ramah, as it's subsequently called. The long full name is in verse 1, but the King James Version shortens it to Ramah thereafter. Ramah was possibly about 10 miles away from Shiloh, and although he had two wives, and that was entirely wrong, it came about probably like this, that under Moses, the law provided sympathetically for proper and due treatment to those who had more than one wife. It didn't really say people could have more than one wife, but for where marriage had been abused and people did have more than one wife, it made certain provisions for both, that they were equitably and fairly and properly treated. And this, it seems, had been abused. This rule that at least looked after the dependents was taken to mean, oh, you could have more than one wife, particularly in the period of the judges and at other times too. And so Elkanah, though he seems to have been otherwise a godly man, and he goes to worship as he should. As a Levite, he doesn't seem to have a regular duty, but he comes across as a pious, earnest man who goes to the house of God annually, makes his sacrifices, honours the Lord, takes vows and so on. But nevertheless, there was a lot of waywardness in those days, and so he has a very unhappy home because there are two wives. Well, you see, he was kind to Hannah. Verse 4, when the time was that Elkanah offered, went to Shiloh, he gave to Peninnah his wife and to all her sons and her daughters portions, made peace offerings for them. And of course they had their portions. But unto Hannah he gave a worthy portion. And if you have a marginal reference, it'll tell you that the Hebrew says a double portion. She had special honour, for he loved Hannah, and he made up to her the fact that she was childless as well as he could. But the Lord had shut up her womb. And verse 6, her adversary, the other wife, provoked her sore. And the Hebrew includes this, she thundered at her, and for to make her fret, because the Lord had shut up her womb. And she particularly did this year by year, when they went up to Shiloh to make their offerings. And what should have been a time of dedication and a happy time was exploited. And so poor Hannah was severely grieved. Verse 7, and as he did so year by year, when she went up to the house of the Lord, so she provoked her, therefore she wept and did not eat. Now, don't let's think that she was exhibiting pique, or this is just self-pity that she did not eat. Actually, in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, there seems to be instruction that you shouldn't eat of the sacrifices if you have a mourning heart and a heavy spirit. You're to eat happily of them. So actually, far from being self-pity and any kind of petulance, this is Hannah being extremely pious and earnest. Because she was so upset, she refrained from participating and eating her portion. And I think that's probably the safest and the best interpretation. Verse 8, then said Elkanah her husband to her, Hannah, why weepest thou, and why eatest thou not? You would have thought he would have known with the commotion in the household, but he doesn't seem to have registered as he should have done. And why is thy heart grieved? Am not I better to thee than 10 sons? Well, there's a clue here. You know, you might well understand if poor Hannah had been grieved at all the insults and the scorn and the hurt. But it seems to me that she was more grieved at the fact that she couldn't bear a Levite boy for the Lord. That seems to be her concern. I so wanted to have a Levite son whom I could present to the Lord. I'm assuming this, but I think that's most of her grief is due to her very strong desire in her womanhood to be able to bring something within the culture of those days for the Lord. And of course, the scorn from the other wife was just to add to that. But this was certainly what I'm saying to you is borne out by her prayer and her actions. Verse 9, so Hannah rose up after they had eaten in Shiloh. It just said she hadn't eaten. But it seems to me that after the comfort that her husband gave her, she must have said to herself, yes, I shouldn't come before the Lord in mourning, because I am grieved at not having a Levite boy to give to the service of the Lord, but I have got a very loving and supportive husband, and I shouldn't grieve unduly, because it appears from verse 9 she did eat after all. So she wasn't one to hang on to her grief and let it spoil the day of others and spoil the family sacrifices. Well, that's my assumption anyway. Well, in verse 9, after they had drunk, now Eli the priest sat upon a seat by a post of the temple of the Lord. Whether he always did so or happened to be there that day, the great man was actually there, where Hannah would pray. And verse 10, she was in bitterness of soul and prayed unto the Lord and wept sore. And look at verse 11. What a beautiful prayer. She prays to God as a personal God, as one who will attend to her case and hear her cry. And her prayer is, O Lord of hosts. That's a beautiful term. In fact, this term appears in the book of Samuel. They're an oppressed people, remember. The Philistines are still there. There's going to be a tremendous battle with the Philistines, which Israel will lose initially. And this Book of Samuel overlaps with the book of Judges. Samson is in another part of the land, even while Samuel is growing up and beginning to officiate. This book doesn't tell us that, but that's the case. And here, she vowed a vow, O Lord of hosts, what a name. We may be an oppressed people, Philistines are around, but I believe in the Lord who has a mighty host of angels and the power greater than any number of armies at his disposal, and he will keep his people. It's a wonderful term of trust. O Lord of hosts, if thou wilt indeed look on the affliction of thine handmaid, not just the fact that she's being criticized and scorned, but she wanted to do something for the Lord. And remember me, and not forget thine handmaid, but will give unto thine handmaid a man-child. Then I will give him unto the Lord all the days of his life, and there shall no razor come upon his head. He'll be dedicated under a Nazarite vow, given over entirely to the Lord. She only asks for one child. She's going to receive more in the Lord's goodness, but she asks for just one, and not for herself, so that he can serve the Lord. So she's a beautiful and pious lady, Hannah. And verse 12, and it came to pass, as she continued praying before the Lord, you know this, I'm sure, this narrative, Eli marked her mouth. She spake in her heart, verse 13 says, only her lips moved, her voice was not heard. And Eli supposed her to be drunk. Why ever would he think that? Presumably because it was quite common in those fairly depraved times. When there was a lot of idolatry, the people of God on the whole were quite wayward. And perhaps there was a lot of this, people who'd actually come in to the house of God. It's referred to not only as the tabernacle, but as the temple in 1 Samuel, which rather suggests that the old tabernacle, the tent, had ceased to be used. Perhaps it was worn out, and buildings had been erected, because you read about doors and such things. So sometimes the language of a tent is used, but more often the language of buildings. And there's a bedroom and other rooms and so on. So it seems that it's not wrong for the term temple to creep in, because although that's a little flamboyant as a term, buildings seem to have been constructed at Shiloh. And you pick this up constantly here. But people had come even into the house of God in a drunken state. And so Eli reproves her sharply in verse 14. And she pleads innocence in verse 15. She does so very beautifully. No, my Lord, I am a woman of a sorrowful spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but have poured out my soul before the Lord. Count not thine handmaid for a daughter of Belial, a worthless one, a drunkard. For out of the abundance of my complaint and grief have I spoken hitherto. Now Eli, in many respects, comes across as a very nice old chap. There's a huge flaw in his conduct, which we'll come across. But he's a very nice man in many ways. He immediately seems to acknowledge his wrong here. He doesn't argue with her or huff and puff. He very graciously says to her, "Go in peace." Her answer completely satisfies him. And he pronounces a great benediction on her, "And the God of Israel grant thee thy petition that thou hast asked of him." He knew well that prayer made out of a very sincere and earnest heart would be heard on high. And she said, "Let thine handmaid find grace in thy sight." So the woman went her way. And look at this, and here's a great challenge for us. "And did eat, and her countenance was no more sad." And we should take note of that. You've got a great problem and a difficulty and something which deeply concerns you, then you should lay it before the Lord. And then you should try to bring under control all your grief and your worry and your concern, and you should say, "I have left it with the Lord." And that's what we should do. Now, I know there are some worries that's not easy to do with. If, for instance, you've got a loved one who's in very great danger, you're bound to, that's an example, you're bound to think of that again and again and again. But there are many other troubles we have which we should be able to forget, having laid them before the Lord. For instance, if somebody's hurt you or wronged you, don't just let it simmer and simmer. Lay it before the Lord and leave it with him. And don't go on coming back to it repeatedly. And I think this is a very beautiful example on the part of Hannah. And so once she'd really prayed to the Lord for help, it was with him. She had her inner longings, but she wasn't going to cry anymore. And verse 19, "They rose up in the morning early and worshipped before the Lord." They've made their sacrifices, but they're still going to carry out daily worship. "And returned and came to their house to Ramah. And Elkanah knew Hannah his wife, and the Lord remembered her. And she conceived," you see that in the verses. "She bore a son, she called his name Samuel, saying, 'Because I have asked him of the Lord.'" And because of this, it was long, long thought that the name Samuel meant asked of God, or asked for. But it doesn't actually mean that. She named him Samuel, which means something like the name of God, and really means something along these lines: the name of God of all strength and power. The name of God stands for his attributes and his power and his goodness. And she gave him a name which reminded her of the attributes and power of God. And she did that for this reason: "Because I have asked him of the Lord." And the man Elkanah and all his house went up to offer. Well, the narrative tells us that she didn't go up the following year or the year after that, but the year after that, when the child was weaned. Now, some very good writers used to say that Samuel was taken to Shiloh, to the house of God, to be presented to Eli at 3 years of age. It took the Hebrews in olden times 2 or 3 years to wean their children. But others, some say, well, this could be used in ancient literature very loosely. And actually, it need not mean strictly weaned, but he could have been 7 or 8 when he was taken. And a lot of people used to take that view. But maybe it's wise to stick to the literal, the implication that maybe in the longest possible period of weaning, 3 years, then he was taken up to Shiloh. Well, anyway, he was taken with a beautiful offering in verse 24, and the bullocks and so on. and she presents the child to Eli. In verse 26, "Oh, my Lord," she's been looking forward to doing this. Her heart is full of emotion. "As thy soul liveth, my Lord, I am the woman that stood by thee here, praying unto the Lord for this child. I prayed, and the Lord hath given me my petition, which I asked of him. Therefore also I have lent him to the Lord." The translation is a little bit in dispute, but I think it's sound and it's good, but it means more along these lines. I have returned him to the Lord. I have given, I have dedicated him to the Lord. As long as he liveth, he shall be lent, dedicated, returned to the Lord. And so Samuel, some people think this refers to Elkanah, but Samuel worshipped the Lord there. Well, let's suppose he was three. He was a little boy. But in that home, and with his spirit, he'd already learned to worship. And the little lad from a sincere heart was old enough to worship the Lord in the temple and know what was going on around him. Well, chapter 2, Hannah prayed, and this is really one of the most wonderful prayers in the Old Testament. And as you know, the theme of this prayer comes into Mary's prayer at the Nativity of Christ, and words and thoughts and the theme comes into Magnificat, the Magnificat, Mary's song of worship. Hannah prayed and said, "My heart rejoiceth in the Lord." You know, we could spend the entire evening on this wonderful prayer. My heart rejoiceth, first of all, not in what the Lord has done, but in him. What a high level of praise this is. My heart rejoiceth in the Lord because he is powerful and holy and good and kind, and I found him and know him and proved him, and he is everything to me. So her praise and worship is directed to him and extolling him and his wonder and his attributes. Mine horn is exalted in the Lord. My mouth is enlarged over mine enemies. Some people say that she has Peninnah in mind, the other wife who scorned her. But I don't think she has that in mind at all. In praising and worshipping the Lord, is she suddenly going to say, "Ah, I've been vindicated against this woman who scorned me"? No, she's not got that in mind. She's talking about the Lord who delivers his people constantly from all their enemies, earthly and spiritual. She isn't being petty or small. "Because I rejoice in thy salvation." Look at verse 2. The holiness of God is there. There is none holy as the Lord. Then the exclusive divine being of God, one God, transcendent over all, for there is none beside thee. The strength, the power, the omnipotence of God, the security we have in him. Neither is there any rock like our God. His immovable, invincible power is in mind. And then verse 3. I think she has herself in mind in verse 3 as much as anyone else. "Talk no more exceeding proudly. Let not arrogancy come out of your mouth." I think she's a very humble woman, but she is so thrilled and so lifted up and so happy, she mustn't give credit to herself or feel self-accomplishment over now having a child, and a Levite child who's going to be dedicated all his life to the service of the Lord, as though it makes her special. "Watch your step," she says to herself. "Mind how you hold yourself and bear yourself." Verse 3, second half, "For the Lord is a God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed. And if I crow and boast like Peninnah or anybody else, God will see it. And God will know my spirit is wrong, and I'm not giving him the glory, but taking pride myself." I think that's what she means in this petition. You may not agree, you may think I've gone too far, but I think she has that very largely in mind. And look at verse 4. The bows of the mighty men are broken, and they that stumbled are girded with strength. These are going to be all the sentiments which show the grace of God. And one after another, the proud and the powerful and the self-confident and the self-reliant, ultimately they will fall, even if it's only when they know their demise in old age and death. The self-confident and self-reliant will fall. God's strange work and his special work is to lift up the humble. What happened when you were saved and Christ heard your call and your repentance? It was because you were brought down from pride and self-sufficiency to need and desire and humility, and you humbled yourself before the Lord and called to him for salvation and grace. This is the strange and particular work of God, to work in this way. And here it is: the bows of the mighty are broken, and they that stumbled are girded with strength. They that were full have hired out themselves for bread, and they that were hungry have ceased to be hungry. So that the barren hath borne 7, the perfect number. She would have 5 more children, to her amazement and happiness. She never asked for that. But you wouldn't have 7. But it's not only about children. This might be in many cases literally true, but it's also true spiritually. There are those who don't have, it would seem, what great opportunities for family and so on. And God uses them mightily to bring them spiritual children. And he uses them in his kingdom magnificently. And it's always true, this kind of sentiment, that the barren hath borne 7, and she that hath many children is waxed feeble. And look at verses 6, 7, 8. I think as you go through this, you can see that in some cases it is literally true. In many cases it is figuratively true, and it's always spiritually true. The Lord killeth and maketh alive. There are cases where somebody is so ill they're as good as dead, and the Lord raises them up again. Then figuratively, we know trials and difficulties and heartaches which might seem to put an end to us, and the Lord delivers us through those trials. And then spiritually, we're brought to see that we are dead and doomed and condemned by sin, and then we're brought to life in Christ and new birth. These sentiments are true any way you wish to look at them. Verse 8, he raiseth up the poor out of the dust and lifteth up the beggar from the dunghill. It may be true literally in many cases, but it's true always in the spiritual sphere. To set them among princes and to make them inherit the throne of glory. Isn't that chiefly true spiritually? The way Christ works, lifting us up from the depths and from the gutter and making us princes in the kingdom of Christ. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and he hath set the world upon them. And even in Hannah's prayer, if people seem to die in poverty and yet they love the Lord, it's all going to be put right. Verse 9, he will keep the feet of his saints. He'll keep them trusting in him. And the wicked one day shall be silent in darkness, for by strength shall no man prevail, certainly to reach the favour of God. And then judgment is reflected in verse 10. The adversaries of the Lord shall be broken to pieces. Out of heaven shall he thunder upon them. The Lord shall judge the ends of the earth, and he shall give strength unto his king, ultimately a reference to Christ, surely, and exalt the horn of his anointed. And when you get that grand climax of a verse, you're aware that all the way through, Hannah has been not only referring to literal earthly blessings which the people of God may enjoy, but also to spiritual blessings, blessings of salvation and eternal life. Now we come to verse 11 of chapter 2. Elkanah went to Ramah to his house, and the child did minister unto the Lord before Eli the priest. So he learned to read the rites and the ceremonies. He ministered. The way it's put, it certainly leads you to believe that he, even from early years, knew the Lord. He did it sincerely, as unto the Lord. He was under the tuition of Eli, but he ministered. Now, the sons of Eli, on the other hand, verse 12, were sons of Belial, drunkards, possibly even idolaters, though it doesn't specifically mention that, utterly unworthy young men. They knew not the Lord. Now I must explain what I believe knowing not the Lord means in these early chapters of 1 Samuel. It doesn't mean, as we would use the term, simply that they weren't believers. It even says of Samuel, very shortly, for he knew not the Lord, when he plainly did, because he ministered before the Lord. He's set down in contrast to the sons of Eli. He understood what he was doing. He clearly did know the Lord. But he didn't know him in the sense that he had never had a vision. He'd never heard, as was the way with prophets, the voice of the Lord audibly addressing him. He didn't know that direct prophetic instrumentality. And certainly the sons of Eli didn't. They were wicked men. Eli knew it. He had obviously been spoken to by the Lord. He must have been, because he knew precisely how to instruct Samuel as a youngster to respond to the Lord's voice and to his call. But his sons didn't, because they were wicked and they knew no activity from the Lord in their priestly ministries. I think that's the sense, because they didn't know him in any sense. And then you read a terrible narrative of how the sons of Eli abused the offerings, and they stole, and they subverted the ceremonial worship for their own ends, and they were utterly profane. It doesn't mention specifically idolatry, but it mentions something just as bad. They went through the motions of the worship and the ceremonial in the house of God, utterly insincerely altering it and changing it to their own ends. And they're going to be severely judged for this. Verse 17, we won't go through the detail. Wherefore the sin of the young men was very great before the Lord. For men abhorred the offering of the Lord. They brought the worship at the house of God at Shiloh into great disrepute by their theft and their altering of the very ordinances of God. And that's something we have to be careful about today, but we'll mention that in a few minutes. Verse 18, but Samuel ministered before the Lord, being a child. I ought to tell you, because this is important when you come to chapter 3, that the word child or boy, the Hebrew word, goes quite a long way up the scale. When David fought Goliath, same word is used of him, a boy. And he obviously was, I would have thought, a mid to older teenager at the very least. You can glean that from the narrative, the way he conducts himself, discusses things, proceeds. Why, you wouldn't have a little child attempting a suit of armour out of... I needn't go into the detail now. So Samuel here in this narrative could be what? Anything, I would think, from 10 to 18. So although child appears here, and we form the impression that he's still a very small child, time has passed, and he's at least a teenager, I would think. Anyway, Samuel ministered before the Lord, being a boy, but one who, if he had been later on like David, could be taking on Goliath, girded with a linen ephod. What a privilege for Eli to have given him the priestly vest, a smaller version of it. He was a Levite, not a priest, but so earnest and sincere was he, and so well accepted, that he clad him as a priest as he functioned before the Lord. I don't think we see that as an irregularity, but it's a tremendous commendation of Samuel. And verse 19, moreover, his mother made him a little coat and brought it to him from year to year when she came up with her husband to offer the yearly sacrifice. She may have come more often than annually, but annually there was a complete outfit for the young man. And Eli blessed Elkanah and his wife and said, "The Lord give thee seed of this woman for the loan or the bestowal which is lent, given to the Lord of Samuel." And they went unto their own home. And the Lord visited Hannah so that she conceived and bare 3 sons and 2 daughters. And the child Samuel grew before the Lord. And then there's this terrible passage from verse 22 about Eli. Now Eli was very old and heard all that his sons did unto all Israel. And something else terrible is added now. They not only stole and not only mangled the ceremonies, and how they lay with the women that assembled at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. And they did it scandalously and openly. This, and he said unto them, "Why do you know this is going to be the meekest, mildest, most inappropriate reproof in the whole of the Bible? What a sad, sad thing." He said unto them, "Why do ye such things? For I hear of your evil dealings by all this people." Everybody knew. Everyone was appalled at the conduct of his sons, the priests. Eli was the high priest. What should he have done? Well, according to the law, these sons of his should actually have died. They should have died for their terrible iniquities. And at the very, very least, they should have been thrown out of the priesthood and taken off function. But he doesn't actually do anything, Eli. He comes across as a nice man in so many ways, but he doesn't do anything about terrible things. And we find that today. You find it in the Christian church. Very often people who seem to be nice people, they overlook terrible things. I'm often talking about this, as you know. You may think it's a bee in my bonnet, but terrible things are going on in worship, terrible things in doctrine, people denying the doctrine of penal substitution, the death of Christ. The Evangelical Alliance there doesn't throw them out. What's happening these days? Some terribly nice people and earnest people, and they just don't seem to mind about the most terrible breaches of God's rules and God's laws. The way people are worshipping, scandalous irreverence and so on, and nobody does anything about it. Why, we thought it was terrible in the early 70s when a college principal of the Baptist Union churches denied the deity of Christ. And the Baptist Union Council said, "We're not going to do anything about it, it's within his rights." What an awful thing. And this kind of thing goes on and on and on. So we're not so surprised after all when we see Eli, a nice chap and a gracious man and a kindly man with a huge blemish of character, in that he will not maintain the discipline of the house of God. And we must. Now, we're a family of God's people, and we want to walk in love and in fellowship and in kindness. And we don't want a shadow to cross the scene of our worship and our fellowship. But if it should happen that somebody committed a terrible sin, we would have to face it. And that person would have to be severely reproved, and if the sin was that bad, put out of fellowship. And we must do it. And you can't say, "No, we'll just be nice, and we pretend this hasn't happened." Well, this was the crime of Eli. And look at this in verse 24. "Nay, my sons, for it is no good report that I hear. Ye make the Lord's people to transgress. If one man sin against another, the judge shall judge him. But if a man sin against the Lord, who shall entreat for him? But he didn't do anything. Notwithstanding, they hearkened not unto the voice of their father, because the Lord would slay them. They'd already gone too far, and the Lord seems to have hardened them judicially in their obduracy and their crime. But by contrast, verse 26, the child Samuel grew on and was in favour both with the Lord and also with men. He was unaffected. What a lad to be unaffected, obviously pained by the things he observed, but he himself uncontaminated, untainted. And so here comes verse 27, a prophet out of nowhere, a nameless prophet, and condemns Eli and brings a word to Eli to say, it's too late, we won't go through the judgment, the arguments have detailed, Eli has neglected his privileges, and he hasn't reproved his sons, and therefore it's too late, and they're going to be severely judged. Some people might think, well, why should judgment fall on Eli's descendants? And why, when the family went on down the centuries, there would be certain judgments? As a family, the descendants would always be poor, the young men would die early, and so on. Well, is that fair? Actually, I see nothing in the judgments to prevent the descendants, even with these afflictions, from turning to the Lord and being personally godly and knowing him and walking with him. But there would be a blight upon the family. Why? Because the Lord is vindictive? No, but there must be for years to come a public sign or demonstration that to abuse with profanity the worship of God and to bring the house of God into disrepute is a terrible crime. And that must be marked for many, many years to come, that the people, the priests and the Levites will be warned, and the prophets and the kings. And so in a sense, it's a warning sign that there is going to be a judgment upon their posterity. And oh, that we'd heed these things today. It is serious when people meddle with worship. It is, you see, sometimes you hear it from the televangelists in the United States, and now it's happening here, that some of these big men over recent years, or last 20, 30 years, have committed adultery, been deposed for just a short while, and then they're back, functioning. And thousands, tens of thousands of Christian people send them money and glad that they're resuming again. And people who've committed adultery and grievously sinned, they say, ah, well, now I have the experience of a fall and a repentance, I'm much more qualified to be a preacher. It's a scandal. It's astonishing. Well, it's all here, isn't it? But I'd much rather tell you about great and gracious things. Let's just move quickly into chapter 3. The child Samuel ministered unto the Lord before Eli. And the word of the Lord was precious in those days. There was no open vision. It was precious like a precious stone. It was rare and special when it happened. And it wasn't a general public thing that there was a prophetic ministry. It would be revived in Samuel. And it came to pass, verse 2, at that time, when Eli was laid down in his place, and his eyes began to wax dim, that he could not see, and ere the lamp of God went out in the temple of the Lord. Of course, it wouldn't go entirely out. The 7-branch lampstand never went entirely out. There would be one stem that would always be alight, but all the other stems would die as the olive oil ran low. Must have been maybe midnight or after. And Samuel was laid down to sleep, but he doesn't actually seem to be asleep. What is he? 13, 14, 15? Who knows? But I would guess at least that the Lord called Samuel, verse 4, and he thought it was Eli. You know the record. The voice in which God called to Samuel must have been something like Eli's voice. I'm sure there was something very special about it, which Samuel didn't actually realize, the nature of the divine call. He'd never had it before. And he ran to Eli. And Eli said, I called not, lie down again. I wonder if Eli at that first call thought, the Lord is speaking to him. But he couldn't face it. My judgment that has been prophesied has come. I am now going to be bypassed. Samuel is old enough. God is speaking. No, it can't be. It can't be. Not yet. Not yet. Put it out of his mind. Maybe I'm over-elaborating. And Samuel went back and the Lord called again. And Eli denied it was he again. And he still didn't seem to catch on or admit this is possibly the Lord. And it wasn't until the fourth time, ultimately. But before then, verse 7, Samuel did not yet know the Lord in the sense, I believe, that I've explained. He'd never heard a voice. He'd never received a vision. But in the sense we use the term, I rather think he did know him. Neither was the word of the Lord yet revealed. But this time, end of verse 8, Eli perceived that the Lord had called the child. It was forced in on his understanding, and he may have been very dismayed for all we know, but he very graciously said, verse 9, go lie down, if it shall be, if he call thee, that thou shalt say, speak, Lord, for thy servant heareth. And you could strengthen the translation, speak, Lord, for thy servant heareth obediently. That's kind of in the Hebrew. So Samuel went and lay down in his place. And look at verse 10. The Lord came. This time anyway, it was as though the Lord spoke in the very room. He came and stood. That can only mean there was a presence as well. And called as at other times, repeating the name. And Samuel answered, speak. For thy servant heareth obediently. And what he had was a very hard word. He may have known it was coming. It may be that Eli had with grief shared with the young man what God had said to him. It may have been known. But what a prophecy to begin his prophetic ministry. A young man, he was obviously strong enough for it, spiritually advanced enough for this. You must tell Eli the condemnation is coming. It's too late to act. It's too late to repent. And he hesitated. And in the morning, though now his prophetic ministry had started, he'd heard the voice of the Lord. The Lord's presence had been in his very room. He'd heard this message that everything was going to change, which clearly implied to him that he would be taking over this ministry, this prophetic ministry. And yet, friends, he still did his basic duties. He went and opened the gates, opened the doors, prepared the temple, the house of God, for the day's ceremonies and ritual. He wasn't arrogant, not puffed up, but eventually he had to tell Eli. And Eli accepts. Look at the gracious side of Eli. Isn't it pathetic? Verse 18, Samuel told him every whit and hid nothing from him. And he said, it is the Lord. Let him do what seemeth him good. Some criticize him for not repenting. The old man was broken. He knew it was too late to repent. He should have done so nevertheless. But it was too late. But Samuel grew, and the Lord was with him, and did let none of his words fall to the ground. He obviously uttered prophecies which came to pass in the region, in his time. leading to enormous respect. And all Israel, from Dan even to Beersheba, 160 miles, knew that Samuel was established to be a prophet of the Lord. And the Lord appeared again in Shiloh. The prophetic ministry now would be established, and revealed himself to Samuel in Shiloh by the word of the Lord. And the mantle was passed from Eli to Samuel. The last judge, the first of a new line of prophets, obedient for years to be prepared for this, accepting humble duties, keeping himself unspotted and untainted from the corruption around him, obeying the voice of God and relaying his first message so faithfully, even though it must have pained him. That's how it ought to be with all of us. Let's close this evening singing a grand old hymn. It's hymn number 546.